You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. We're having some technical difficulties today. I'm having some difficulties speaking. We have a very special show today, reaching out to pop culture, but in an interesting way. We'll start off with a discussion of last week's big controversy about the Hamilton casting notices. Then Susie Evans, our
senior editor.
Sorry, it's that kind of a day. We'll talk about Bogota, where she went to the international festival, and then we will set up Deep Trans interview with
Cynthia Ling Lee and Rebecca Mwasa. And hello, I'm Deep Tran, your associate editor. It's fine. People know our voices by now.
Yes, and I'm Susie.
Yes.
They're going to talk about cultural appropriation and Beyonce, which is a departure for us, but I think they're both theater artists, and I think they have interesting stuff to say about a non-theatrical but very relevant cultural phenomenon. So let's just jump right in here. Hamilton last week, they're casting replacements for the show. I guess the folks who've been in the show since last
and
January.
Tours.
Yeah, exactly. They're reaching out in their casting efforts. And I believe the casting notice says seeking non-white actors. And there was a lawyer who jumped on this, and Equity agreed with him that the language of using, referring to actors seeking talent with a racial characterization was not legal. But, of course, as many people pointed out, this is a stupid controversy because, you know, it is, in a way, semantic, because the casting notices regularly say who the race of the character is. I guess there's a technicality by which, even though it specifies the race, they'll consider other ethnicities, and sometimes casting notices do say that. It's tricky with Hamilton because, I think the original casting specified models which were from hip-hop. Is that correct? And it didn't necessarily break down everyone's ethnicity.
No, the original casting notice was for characters, and every character was specified as non-white.
I think the difference here is it's an open call casting notice.
Right, okay. Because it was open call, and they just said, like,
seeking non-white
actors. No one might need to apply, right?
Yeah. So it's technically, it's discriminatory against white actors because you can't, everyone should be able to come audition no matter what race they are. So you can't limit the people auditioning, but you can limit the character.
Well, it's not limiting the character so much as letting you know how the creators see the character.
Exactly.
Which is an important thing. It's funny because, like, maybe 20 years ago, casting notices did not specify ethnicity as much, I don't think. It was more like people were called on the fact that they were just doing default Caucasian. They were like, it wouldn't say, and if it didn't say, that meant no race, right? And if it said race, then it was a race. So now casting notices, to a fault, specify the ethnicity with this Caucasian. And I think it actually, helps directors and cast directors think about this, right? I guess it's the flip side of being color conscious rather than color blind. If we're color conscious, we have to be color conscious and ready for discussions about what it means to be conscious of who's in the room and who's not in the room. And it's going to create, controversy.
I mean, Hamilton's an interesting case too, because usually when something specifies the race of a character, like this character is Asian, this character is African American. Hamilton's a case where the people of color can play any role.
It's true.
Hamilton has to be Latino. He could be African American. He could be Asian. It's just the people of color is the impetus. So there's not a specific race that the character is.
Except for King George, who's white.
But also it's interesting. I mean, I don't know the ethnic background of anyone who's in the ensemble, but there, and not that this is like excusing all the controversy, but there were some Caucasian people in the original ensemble.
There are, yeah. There's a few. No, it's true. I mean, I'm thinking back to when I first spoke to Lynn and the folks involved in January, before it was known that it was going to Broadway and be a hit. I think people knew it was going to be something special. And he was saying, when the high school production goes out, if you cast this to look like the Founding Fathers, you've done something wrong. And I remember Leslie Odom saying specifically, he looks forward to seeing an Asian American burr, for instance, not specifically.
But or
for
a female instance, burr. There was a big talk about how they're opening it up to women for burr and.
And I think it was a rumor that got debunked because the reason that they can't, it's not as easily transposable to women is because they would have to rewrite to the.
Yeah. That was a while ago, but something more recently said that they're auditioning women for Burr and other role.
I'm pretty sure that was just a rumor.
I think it's
true.
Should
we look this up?
That does sound like a rumor. Right,
yeah. I think when it comes to casting characters versus seeking particular actors, I feel like it's a distinction without a difference, because when something says Caucasian, for the most part, they're going to, when it says they're looking for a Caucasian cast, like in the instances of like Bright Star on Broadway.
But they didn't say that. They said
they were looking for characters.
Yeah. All the characters were Caucasian. I'm sorry. Right. I've misspoken. But they did end up casting all Caucasians. It's not like any actors of color came in and changed their minds.
Right.
And when you open it up to any race, most of the time casting directors will default to Caucasian as well. So I think it's revelatory that Hamilton was looking specifically for non-white actors, but it's just a matter of semantics.
Yeah, it is illegal it's like an equal opportunity employment clause, which I know it sounds ridiculous because obviously they're not including white, which is, you know, that's a whole nother conversation in and of itself, but.
Yeah, it is semantic, but I think it's important to talk about intentions. And again, being color conscious means being conscious of these kind of semantics. As opposed to colorblind, which I think colorblind we've debunked as an idea.
Yeah, I think it's also, when we're talking about color conscious, also being aware, I think you and I talked about this, Rob, about if you're looking to cast a work and it's all the characters are white, I think there might be an issue there that you should look closer at.
Yeah, sure. No, well, that's definitely true. I do feel like if you want to tell specifically a story where you're very specific and conscious that the characters are white, I think you should think about that, what that says. And if that's the point of a show like Appropriate, that is the point
yes,
of a show
definitely.
Like Appropriate. Or a play like
Anything by Eugene
Disgrace.
O'Neill?
I don't know about Eugene O'Neill. That's interesting.
Really
I mean,
Irish.
Yeah, no.
I've seen an all-black Eugene O'Neill play.
That's
well, you
true.
Could do all-black. Also, there were people of color in his plays, Emperor Jones and Iceman Cometh has. No, yeah, well, it gets complicated. But I would say Disgrace, for instance, is very specifically about all four characters have to be specifically cast. Five, sorry. Have to be cast specifically. So plays are written with specific ethnicities in mind.
And when I talked to Ray Pamatmat for our March issue, I mean, plays are written for specific ethnicities that aren't about race. That's not the point of the story. That's just
right,
the way
just to
be
the
cast.
Story be
like,
told.
He talked a lot about Edith can shoot things and hit them. Like,
most players of color, and I've talked to Mike Liu about this, they prescribe the race because they know that if they don't put a race in, casting directors and directors will default to white. It's just an unconscious bias.
Unless
we
the
all
play
have.
Is about Chinese culture.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, I'm sure Lin saw something like that. He's written a show about the founding fathers, and he needs to specify that this is how the show
is. It
is
a complicated thing. I don't want to preview my recommendation, but it's been pointed out, you know, this is still. These are still all white characters in history. So it's a big deal that they're being played by people of color. And it's part of the conception of the show that they should be played by people of color.
Right. And I think a lot of the anger from the artists of color that I knew, it was because this was a rare moment for actors of color to show off their talent in leading multifaceted roles in the biggest hit on Broadway. And then when the controversy, and side note, I don't even think it was that much of a controversy
because it lasted
5 hours.
Yeah.
And
but
I didn't see any Caucasian actors who were mad about it.
A lot of the posts I saw were from Broadway actors who were like, this is stupid.
Yeah.
Why is this
a
controversy?
It was that one lawyer who like brought it up.
Yeah. He's
one lawyer.
An American
well, and then
civil
of course,
rights
equity,
lawyer.
Equity yeah. did step up. I think, all that's true. I think the outrage was ridiculous. I think somebody screwed up and it wasn't conscious enough in their wording and
of
just
course.
Should have known that.
Of
yeah,
course,
it was they
course.
Screwed up the wording on a legal basis, but their hearts are in the right place. And
I think it was also because, like, these actors, they see Hamilton as a big opportunity. And then when this thing came up, it felt like kind of the white institutions kind of like bearing down and wanting to be a part of something that's not for them. And I also feel like it's also indicative of the fact that there isn't enough opportunities for actors of color. And so there should be more opportunities so that when something like Hamilton comes up, it's not like the once in a lifetime chance you're going to have to get to play a leading role on Broadway.
That's true. No, I mean, I don't think any institutions, except for Equity, which is a big one.
I mean, it felt like
came
it.
Out.
Yeah,
the person I mean, who
you're
initially
talking about one lawyer and a bunch of stupid right wing media and Equity,
yeah.
which is not nothing, but it was all kind of like set right. I think,
and the lawyer was an African American civil rights lawyer,
right? Who's looking for things to
yeah.
sue people over,
or Hamilton tickets.
That we get to the bottom of it.
Oh,
make
that,
a headline with Hamilton and get tickets.
Well,
good point.
The show has a lot of money. I mean, maybe it was
yeah.
ulterior motives.
Yeah, so silly controversy, but obviously people need to, you know, just be, again, I think color conscience needs to continually be raised. Not on all sides. It's not equivalent, but particularly, you know, for opportunities for people who haven't had the chance.
And someone like Hamilton shouldn't be the exception. That's basically
no,
it.
I know. And, yeah. and you know, we could tiptoe up to the idea that we've talked about before. I think we've talked about this before, is that when a, let's say a classical musical is revived and they cast only white people in it, that's a problem. It can be. But we don't have to talk about that now. Let's see. You went to Bogota, Susie. Tell me about that. You went there last year and wrote about the Great Colombian Theater yourself.
2 years ago.
2 years ago, sorry. And this year, is it biennial? Is that, it's not every
year? It's every 2 years. It's the Ibero-American Theater Festival. It's
every so you go every years. Time, but it's only 2 years ago.
Been twice.
So you went and saw the Great Colombian Theater before, but this time you focused on, it's an international festival, so it's people
it
coming
is,
to Bogota.
It is, yeah. There's a lot of people coming to Bogota. This year they had a Nordic focus on like Scandinavian countries and Iceland. One of my favorite shows that I saw was the show called Blam! Exclamation point, all in caps. from Iceland.
Amazing.
I think it was a partnership between Iceland and Denmark because the company was Danish. And it was basically, there was no talking. It was completely silent. It was these four guys in an office. It kind of reminded me of like Gats meets The Office meets Cirque du Soleil. And they did like all this like physical comedy in an office. And it ended with them like pretending to be Marvel superheroes with like a fog machine, and it was one of the greatest things ever. It was hilarious.
They should set up next to Stomp here.
Right? I know they yeah. should come to the States. They're touring. I'm like, I hope they're coming to the States. It was so great. But yeah, so it was a Nordic influence. It's a 3 week festival in Bogota. There's a lot of South American theater, but there's some other countries to come in. So I saw a show from Korea. It was very interesting. I saw a show from Hungary. I saw a great clowning show from Russia, Slava Snow Show. I also really enjoyed that. No talking in that one.
Slava Snow Show? Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you seen Slava Snow
yeah,
Show?
Yeah, it was you know, at Union Square Theater for years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, I saw it in Bogota.
Wow.
It was great.
I'm glad it's still around. Yeah, it's great.
Another one I saw that I really enjoyed was the Tiger Lilies perform Hamlet. It's
wow.
this London Ooh. Band, the Tiger Lilies,
yes,
partnered
actually,
with this.
I've heard them, yeah.
Partnered with this Danish theater company and did this like very inventive take on Hamlet. It was still Hamlet, like they did all the main speeches, but there were these awesome projections and clowning and like music added, and like Ophelia's drowning scene was epic. Basically, they put this woman on this harness and they had a projection of the ocean on the back wall, and she walked up the wall. And then when she like fell backwards to drown, it made like a huge splash on the projection, and this music that the band was playing, it was like one of the coolest theatrical moments I've ever
and
seen.
And still got that guy with a super high falsetto.
Yeah. It was really great. I mean, it's a fun thing. It's every 2 years. There were two American companies. Sorry, I didn't see either one. Sergio. Oh, I forget what his last name is. This is terrible. Arabel? Is that?
I don't know.
Oh,
this American company.
His first name is Sergio, and he has choreographed things on Broadway, of which I don't remember any of their names. And
not Trujillo.
Yeah, Trio. That might be it. Sergio Trio.
Yeah, yeah.
That sounds right. I thought that was it, but I thought that was like a photographer name, and now I'm wrong. Sergio Trio, and he brought I think it's called Arabelle. That was before I got there. And then, there was Diavolo in Motion, which is like an architecture dance piece from LA that was there. Yeah, it's a cool fest.
Isn't Sergio Trujillo the choreographer of On Your Feet?
Ooh, maybe it wasn't Sergio Trujillo.
I could be wrong.
We obviously don't know what we're talking
totally
about.
Wrong territory here. And you know, since we're using our phones today to record, little secret, inside secret, we can't look up things on our phones. So
I know.
I can look up things on this laptop I'm sitting in front of.
No, that's all right. We've let people behind the curtain too much already. So, well, we look forward to a report on that in our July, August issue. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, report on around the world in Bogota.
Oh, question, Susie.
Yeah.
So what's it like? Were there subtitles for the works, or did you just watch it?
It depends. So, like, the Tiger Lilies Perform Hamlet was in English because it was a British and Danish company. Blam had no dialogue, so it was just, like, sounds, and it was so good. But then the Korean one, it was called A Family on the Road, there were Spanish subtitles because it's in Colombia, so they do Spanish subtitles. So I didn't understand a lot of it because it was in Korean with Spanish subtitles, but it was interesting.
Wow.
Did it take away from the enjoyment of the work when you don't understand it and can't read?
There was one show I saw that I just flat out did not understand. It was from Mexico. It was called Banos Roma, and it was about a lot of, like, the women disappearing and being, like, violently assaulted in Mexico. It was really interesting, but it was entirely in Spanish, and I don't speak Spanish, and when there's no subtitles, like, I can, like, understand some Spanish when it's in subtitles because I speak French, and so there's, like, similar words, but when there's no, it wasn't in subtitles because the language was Spanish, and I legit just didn't understand anything, so I won't be writing about that one because I don't really know what was happening, but the people that spoke Spanish seemed to really enjoy it, so.
International festivals, yeah, the one I went to in Russia, only about half the shows were headphones with spoken word or subtitles.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that was cool.
Fancy.
That was
like
cool.
A UN,
but you know,
the
other one I saw was a giant production of Seagull, but I basically know the outline of the play, even though it was the weirdest Seagull I've ever seen, so I didn't know a lot of what was happening, but it was great.
Yeah, the Hamlet one had Spanish subtitles too, but I understood it because it was in English.
No, yeah, I saw a show once last year, like The Monkey King, like 2 years ago at Lincoln Center Festival, and after a while I just stopped reading the subtitles because you start reading those and stop paying attention to the visuals.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's how I feel when I go to the opera. I'm like, what?
Forget it, yeah.
Yeah, the thing that's frustrating about opera is that so many operas, arias are repetitious, so I'm reading again, like, I've already seen that. Okay, can I just watch the stage? Wait, oh, I'm missing something. You don't know when there's new information. It should be like a different color when it's new information.
I know, or I feel like it's like they just said a paragraph and there's just one line.
Right, no. Yeah, it's true. That's opera. Well, speaking of another cultural form, Deep, you spoke to – this is the artist's idea, and it came to us through our communications director, Gus Schulenberg.
Yes. I had a Skype conversation with Cynthia Ling Lee, who is bicoastal, San Francisco and Atlanta, and she's a Taiwanese.
That's bicoastal.
Yeah. There's a coast.
Geography.
I'm a writer.
So Cynthia Ling Lee is a Taiwanese-American choreographer and scholar of North Indian Kathak dance. And her works include Suna Otomi Sister and Super Rasi. I just really did not do well on those pronunciations. And the second guest was Rebecca Mwasa, who is a New Orleans-based performance artist. And her work includes Go Ye Therefore and Cry Ye One. And they wanted to talk about Beyoncé and specifically her recent music videos, Formation, which was set in New Orleans, and Him for the Weekend, a duet with Coldplay set in India. And they talked about cultural appropriation versus cultural exchange and how they navigate that in their work as foreigners to the place that they talk about. So it was a really interesting conversation.
Great, great. Over to that.
So hello again. We are sitting down with two fantastic theater artists slash performers, Cynthia Ling Lee. Where are you based, Cynthia?
I am normally in Greensboro, North Carolina, but I spend a lot of my year in California, in Los Angeles in particular.
And we're sitting down with Rebecca Mwasa, who is in New Orleans.
I aspire to also someday be bicoastal.
Well, before we go any further, let's take a listen at some of the song snippets that we'll be talking about today. Rock his rock necklaces. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama. I like my baby hair with baby hair and afro. I like my Negro nose with Jackson 5 nostrils. I earned all this money, but they never take the country out me. I got hot sauce in my bag, swag. That was Formation, and now let's listen to Him for the Weekend. You should create a dance with that, Cynthia. That was fantastic.
I already did, but you can't see it on the podcast. Doing it on Skype. Actually, I'm part of a web-based transnational collective, so
yes.
Skype dances are not that far from our reality.
Well, both of you are, you're not in, indigenous or native to the art form slash cultures that you represent within your work, and so there's been a lot of criticism at Beyoncé and Coldplay for appropriating these elements of India. And so, like, how do you approach those iconic images as someone who isn't from the place that you work with?
When you're saying the iconic images, are you referring to the images in the Coldplay video?
Yes, Coldplay video, and then okay. There's also the NOLA images with the water, and
I approach the video partially as a critical dance studies scholar and partially as somebody who is not South Asian but is Taiwanese American, is Asian American, and is very, very familiar with exotification and discourses of Orientalism. And so if I do a really quick read of the video back to you, which of course comes from a different perspective than it would of a South Asian or South Asian American perspective, and those are multiple as well. If you look at it, it's a series of Orientalist colonial fantasies of India. It's actually very standard and it's very expected. I'm like, a literally white British dude goes back to the colony and encounters fire breathers and sadhus and, you know, Hindu mystical people, and has an ecstatic experience with poor children in the street throwing colored powder during Holi, and dunks himself in the water and achieves spiritual enlightenment. I mean, it's a standard kind of story, colonial narrative. I actually think Beyoncé's role in the video is more ambiguous and more interesting than Chris Martin's, which is kind of like, we can just dismiss it pretty clearly as being a problematic white British dude doing a standard Orientalist, like, treating the East as a spiritual, you know, place frozen in the past. It's just like, it's not even interesting to really talk about it too much to me. Mm-hmm. But I think Beyoncé's position is more ambivalent because of her being a Black American woman, because of the kind of ambiguity of the relationships between Asian Americans and African Americans in the U.S. context, but then we're also looking at this India and U.S. relationship, so we're also thinking about U.S. cultural imperialism, and we're thinking about the really deep economic differences between India and the U.S. There's also a history, not very kind of strongly spoken about that much, but of anti-Blackness. You know, recently there have been many more like African people who will come for university education in India because it's pretty cheap English, high quality mm-hmm. education, who are targeted in the streets. So a lot of folks have talked about the video in terms of like promoting a kind of anti-Blackness. On the other hand, you know, You can also accuse her of engaging in cultural appropriation. I think it's very complex, actually, to look at her positionality in the video. And I'm also curious what Rebecca would say. But I think my stance is that, for me, she doesn't really accrue a lot of power through the way that she engages in this video. She takes on this Orientalist trope. She's beautiful. She's exotic. But she doesn't have agency visually. She doesn't have agency in the narrative. She's gazed upon all of the time. Like, it, to me, it doesn't actually bolster her, because I think of the complicated power relationships in which we're operating. That's my own read. What do you think?
Yeah, I, you know, with Him for the Weekend, which I think both of these, so funnily enough, I don't think I saw either of these videos until I came to your house, Cynthia.
Oh, by the way, Rebecca and I know each other.
We know each other. We're friends. We love each other.
Oh, good, great. Good. So I don't have to do much talking. Great.
it's funny, right? With Him for the Weekend, I feel like I agree with pretty much all of what Cynthia said. You know, the power in that video lies with Coldplay and this dude, like this white dude being like, I own all these things, including this like beautiful black woman over here who's going to be pretty for me. You know, I think about colorism in India and colorism in the United States and like what the standards of beauty are that have been created across, like globally, within white Eurocentric colonialism and imperialism, right? Like Beyonce, one of the ongoing critiques and realities of her popularity is that she is popular particularly because she is a very light-skinned black woman and capitalizes on the whiteness of her features and the lightness of her skin and the, mm-hmm. you know, and increases the blondness of her hair in order to perpetuate, right, this idea that the only way that you can be beautiful in this country and in the world is to have these more European features, right? Although she also celebrates her butt and celebrates, like, the movements that are considered indicative of, like, Africanness and blackness, right? Like, she holds this multiplicity, which is, I think, part of the reason she's so popular and is also part of the reason she's been able to move to the heights of pop culture. But if she were a dark-skinned woman, whether she was Indian or American or otherwise, she wouldn't have, her beauty would not even be seen in that way. It wouldn't be recognized as something valuable that anyone, let alone some white dude from Britain, would want to uphold as beautiful, right? Like, when I think about the women who tend to be held up in acclaim in India and in Bollywood films, their coloring and they look similar, right? Like, there are similarities there. It was an interesting tokenizing of Beyonce in this moment of wanting to be sort of multiracial across the Western world within the like colonialist context of India, you know? But I also agree she was an accessory. Mm-hmm. Right, which is also, I think, about patriarchy and what it means.
Yeah,
and what it means for women to be baubles, to be like ways to show wealth or power that aren't necessarily in anything more valuable than their beauty or their like sexuality, which is interesting when you juxtapose that against like the Super Bowl performance where she like just like ran all of those men, but like that was not about Coldplay, it was not about Bruno Mars, like that was her show that they happened to be extras in,
right? But then there's this question of her pretending to be a Bollywood star and them like taking the actual mm-hmm. Bollywood star and placing her in maybe a 2 second frame.
Well, and I think that brings in the American cultural imperialism piece, right, that yep. Cynthia alluded to earlier, is that Even within this video, there's the globalized context of who is the woman that we choose to be the symbol, right? She's not going to be a woman from India. She's going to be a woman from America. And if she's a woman from America, who is currently our most highly sexualized and desirable woman? It's Beyonce, so it's going to be her, right? So the idea of cultural privilege, I feel like, is a good segue into talking about form.
Yes!
Talking about Formation.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yes, girl, yes. Yeah, well, and so here, okay, so the way that I watched Formation was at Cynthia's birthday party / Chinese New Year celebration in Greensboro.
It was my request for my birthday present. I said, Rebecca, please watch this video and read it back to me as my birthday present. I was like, okay. You're like, dumplings and pig's feet, you know.
Yes.
It sounds like a fantastic time.
Yeah. It was so great. It was wonderful. I also... There's so much in that video. There's so much.
And she's so powerful in it too, as opposed to in the Coldplay video.
Completely. Yeah,
it's her video, right? So she has a bunch more agency and power. It's also interesting to me because I feel like I've read like 30 articles about Formation from all different standpoints. And okay, I'm going to run through it like I did at Cynthia's house.
Do it.
I will preface all of this by saying, again, like, I'm not from New Orleans, so, like, my reads are going to be as, like, a Black feminist and as someone who has existed in spaces in which I continuously see people outside of New Orleans and people in positions of power and privilege using New Orleans as a way to make more money. So, there was incredible imagery in that video. My favorite moment is when that young Black boy is dancing in the hoodie in front of the police, like riot police. It's just phenomenal. I also, I go back and forth between wanting to applaud Beyoncé for all of these really phenomenal images, knowing two things. One, she didn't direct the video, so I don't know how many of those ideas were hers and how many were the people that she employed, but whoever she employed is a genius, right? Mm-hmm. Two, all of the things that were read into the video around like Black power and liberation and all of this stuff is coming on a read based on people's personal experiences, right? And like that's the power of art, is that it has the ability for us to take whatever we are full of, our stories, our analysis, our experiences, and project them onto what we're viewing, right? And then to pull meaning from that. And so what I appreciated was the depth and the breadth of the dialogues that occurred after watching that video. So things that I saw, right? Beyoncé as commentary on being fabulous and slaying, right? Which is like great. Her, that low brimmed black hat when she was like flipping people off in front of the plantation mansion gave me all of my life. Like, I need that hat. I need all of the jewelry. I need everything. It was so good. So good. These moments of Black women in powerful positions, dancing in the parking lot, sitting in the Victorian mansion, the Black baby girls just being cute, right? All of that was amazing. There's all these images of like Black women in their beauty and in their power. There's a moment where she talks about her mom being like Louisiana Creole and her dad being Bama, which like Alabama. Is hard
yeah.
for me as someone who like grew up in the South my whole life, the South of the United States, and understands the historical context of that word and like what it means to be a Bama, and that being a derogatory term at pieces in Black, at moments in Black history. And so when Beyoncé talks about, being part Creole and her mom being from Louisiana and her, dad being Obama, or, from Alabama, I think about the context of those words, right? The context of Creolization in New Orleans and what that means in terms of like paper bag tests and like the light of your skin allowing you access and privilege and education and mobility that darker skinned people don't have now or historically, and the relationship of that to the construction of Blackness and the ways in which Beyoncé chooses to highlight or lowlight her Blackness depending on what she's trying to capitalize on, right?
And can you talk a little bit, Rebecca, about this notion of like using NOLA to capitalize on a particular project? And so, was this video guilty of that?
I think so. So first of all, the video wasn't, as far as I understand it, most of it was not shot in New Orleans, right? Mm-hmm. It was shot in a studio. There's some B-roll from actually up the street from where I live.
And they use a real NOLA documentary, too, like a real New Orleans documentary.
Then they use the documentary about New Orleans for pieces of the thing. There's, you hear the voices of Big Frida, who's this amazing bounce performer, and of Messy Maya, who was a social media personality, and someone who was murdered a few years after the storm. And that's it. And then you see the NOPD, the New Orleans Police Department car that Beyoncé lays on and is submerged underwater. I think, so for me, as someone who moved to the city post-Katrina, it is really difficult for me to see an artist like Beyoncé take what could have been a way to invest in the city, invest in local artists, invest in raising a different narrative or calling attention to a different narrative that we don't see all the time about New Orleans' ability to resist and respond to centuries of degradation and humiliation and like aggressive racial policies by white supremacy, right? And instead throw back at us the same images, right? The images of houses being submerged in water, and of her body on top of a cop car, which that moment in the video for me was one of the hardest, because I was like, what are you trying to say there? Like, the weight of your body is enough to you know, rid us of the prison industrial complex and like the role of police in extending the brutality of like brutalization of Black people's bodies, because like that's not true. It's not like, right. And this idea of sort of individual versus collective resistance, right? Like, New Orleans has this deep, deep history of collective resistance, right? Like, the largest slave revolt in the nation happened here in 1811. The Black Panther Party took over a housing development here and like did free lunch programming and started daycares and did all this work. Like, the Free Southern Theater was here making art and finding ways to teach people how to read so they could, and doing voter registration drives. Like, there's all of this other stuff, right? That if you want to pick a historical moment that happened in New Orleans, Katrina wouldn't be the one that I would choose, because it's not a moment of triumph, right? It's a moment of deep sorrow and trauma where people were ripped apart from their families and like ripped apart from their homes and then forced to come back into a space where they weren't wanted. And so to lift that up, and then put her body in front of it as if it's just like a backdrop. I've seen repeatedly celebrities come and they have a moment with New Orleans where they're like, oh, we care about you. We care about what happened. We care about the housing crisis or the lack of grocery stores or whatever. And they're here for a minute and then they're out. There's no deeper investment. There's no direct connection to communities. There's not a moment to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and to really see what people here are asking for, what people here are saying that they need. There's this idea that I'll come in and I'll tell you what to do, and that for me is a sort of cultural privileging. It's like, I know better than you, and I know the ways in which I can support, so I'm going to do this thing. And then like, now it's over, okay, bye, have fun, right? And so seeing that, I mean, immediately I thought about, man, I really hope my friends from New Orleans don't watch this video because it's going to trigger the shit out of them. That video didn't make the schools better. It didn't lessen the food desert. It didn't,
right.
You know, it didn't decrease the affordable housing crisis. Like, it didn't do any of those things. And so as artists, if we think about our work as in some way contributing to the social discourse and to move people in a direction where they're pursuing policies or practices or trying to affect change. Yeah. I don't know. Cynthia, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to connect this to a sort of a larger question that Diep, not a larger one, but one less specific to New Orleans that Diep actually brought up in her email question. So you're asking about the difference between cultural appropriation and cultural exchange, right? And I actually think Rebecca exactly articulated that, like, an exchange requires a back and forth. It requires a dialogue. It requires an exchange of resources, of thinking, and it requires somebody to learn and to be humble and to also give back and not just to take and to capitalize on. So it has something to do with the monologue versus the dialogue thing that Rebecca was talking about. But another thing that I think is interesting to think about is, do you have a lived relationship to this place, this culture? And I think that that is something that sometimes I find gets lost in conversations about cultural appropriation. They often revolve around, what's your position? Do you walk through the world, you know, experiencing the same kind of oppression that, say, a Black American experiences? And if not, then, and you want to take on elements of that culture, then you better think about that twice. And that's very, very, very true. But I also think there's a big difference between somebody who, you know, say Beyonce had grown up in New Orleans. That would be a different question, right? So what's your lived real experience to it? What's your position in the system of power? And what are the historical contexts surrounding the artistic work that gets created? And what is the current political moment? So in relationship to Him for the Weekend, India is currently, let's see if I get in trouble with this statement, India is currently in a situation where the government in power is a Hindutva entity. It's a Hindu nationalist, some would argue fundamentalist, government. And so you take this kind of dehistoricized, orientalized, decontextualized image of India that's completely Hindu, to the exclusion of Muslims, to the exclusion of Christians, to the exclusions of all the various religious, you know, minorities in India that are folks who are not Hindu, in what is actually a secular country, and you put forward this image of India that is completely plays into a Hindu nationalist image, and the pluralism of India, which is real, that is real. Like, the plurality, the secularism, the competing voices, the fact that for every like particular hardened stance, there's 5,000 like counter narratives, that is not present in the Coldplay video. And so that video does harm in the world, in this historical moment and in this political moment. So I would consider all of those things when thinking about whether something is cultural exchange or appropriation.
We're like well over time, but I really wanted to talk to you both about just your work in particular, because Cynthia, I know you've dealt with like how women are treated in India in one of your works, and also like how India influences your own life within your own dance works. And Rebecca, you talk about the loss of NOLA wetlands and also about NOLA post Katrina. And so can you just tell me a little bit about like how do you navigate like that exchange when constructing those pieces?
So multiple things. One, I am a first generation Zimbabwean American, right? So I'm the child of Southern African immigrants from Zimbabwe. And I live in New Orleans, which, you know, is often touted as the most African city in the United States. And for me, it feels true, right? It's part of the reason I moved here. It's part of the reason I can exist here in the fullness of my Black Africanness in ways that doesn't feel true in other places, because the cultural Blackness allows for plurality in the ways that Blackness is expressed here in ways that that's not true in other places. And so in my work, I will say that the things I have investigated are the ideas of identity as this moldable, formulated thing within white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, and capitalism, and what that does to the body, and how those oppressions exist, and how they are transformed, right? Like, that's what my work is about. And so, in doing that in New Orleans, right, the exchange is around how are the contexts in which I have lived, and different collaborators that I've worked with here have lived, how do they speak to each other? What are the similarities and differences? And where there are linkages and where there are not. And in the places where there aren't, like, that is, for me, the juiciest information and the juiciest places to dig, right? Is that I can talk about my story and connect to all these other stories and find ways to lift them up within something I'm creating, but I wouldn't be able to do that if I wasn't in conversation, right? And it's also a way of, I think, honing what it is you're trying to say, right? Because what exists is, and I think what going back to Beyonce for a moment, like, takes away or does not allow, is there's this idea of this monolithic blackness, right? And it doesn't exist, right? Like, blackness was created specifically so that whiteness could exist. And so to be from New Orleans or to be from Zimbabwe does and does not mean a lot of things. And so to be able to have agency in framing that experience and in transmitting what that is, I think is really important. And the last thing I'll say is, like, related to Crying Land, and which is a piece about the loss of land and culture in Southeast Louisiana, you know, entering into that piece was really difficult for me for a lot of reasons. You know, I've lived here and I love this land, and it breaks my heart that it's disappearing at this alarming rate. And that part of its disappearance is, again, related to, like, systematic racism, who experiences the major effects of climate change tend to be Native Americans and Black folks, whose homes are closest to the factories, closest to the rivers, are the ones who had to move for the Bonnie Carey spillway to be made, right? Like, the people who are actually most impacted by this are those who I share the closest relationship with on a broad sort of racial, cultural, economic vein. And so what does it mean to know that, but also know that that doesn't mean I know them, right? Or, like, know their experiences, right? So the again, like, I have to be in dialogue, and my creative practice thus far has been one in which so much of the research and development process is about listening, is about going out and finding people who've actually done the things, experienced the things, been to the places, or people similar to me, to have conversations about what happened, about when they could look out in their backyard and go fishing because it was a marsh, about what New Orleans looked like 20 or 40 or 50 years ago, about what my grandmother remembers about Zimbabwean cultural and religious practices before she was a Christian, right? Like, those are the things that are foundational for the work to be made. And then, yeah, I mean, one of the things, and this is the last thing I'll say, like, the sort of artistic license that I feel like is often thrown around as, like, an excuse for artists to be careless with their work, mm-hmm. And to not deeply investigate it, and to not have a dialogue, and to say, well, it was my artistic license to say that way. But I make work that's accountable to my community, right? And so if I am accountable to the New Orleans community, being people who have moved here since the storm, people who lived here before the storm, and all those in between, then I have a mandate, a requirement, an expectation that my work is going to not only be in dialogue, but be consistent. Like, the amount of work in progress showings that I had for my last show, it was like, I had like 9 of them. I did reading, all these things. And, like, is that stuff necessary? Not for other people, but it is for me to know that, like, the story that I'm sharing, and that I'm going to have the capability, because of my privileges as an artist, to travel, to do my work in other places, to talk about New Orleans in the context of Beyonce and formation with American theater. And it's not one of my friends from New Orleans, right? It's not, because they don't have the same relationships to national organizations, whatever the reason, right? Means that it is my duty to speak from a place that is holding space for all of that. And it's not just me talking about what I do and how great it is.
Cynthia, I wanted to ask you about your work and how you navigate not being Indian yourself. How do you navigate not being appropriative when it comes to using that kind of iconography, costumes, movement within your work?
It's a complicated, interesting question. And I would say that, first of all, the various Indian classical dance forms, including Kathak, have gotten bound up in an Indian nationalist agenda. Indian nationalist Hindu patriarchal agenda. And so because I have that training as a critical dance scholar, I also have a little bit of a wish to align myself with the syncretic, pluralistic, secular, or in secular in an Indian definition, not in a U.S. one, which actually means multiple religions rather than like not religious. I have a sort of political desire to align myself with a different version of the history that has squashed out women's voices, low caste voices, minority voices, Muslim voices, especially in Cuttack has deep, deep, deep Muslim influence. That's like not even really debatable. And I'm part of a collective. I feel sort of the need to and desire to acknowledge my collaborators. So I'm part of a collective called the Postnatyam Collective, and we're this, as I mentioned earlier, this transnational web-based coalition of artists who work on critical and creative approaches to South Asian dance. And we have a process that's very much about dialogue and negotiation and privileging multiple perspectives and kind of treating differences in opinion as an opportunity for political learning and trying to figure out allyship and not trying to create a monolithic voice for how to make contemporary Indian dance, for example. So that's one thing. So in terms of me and exchange and appropriation and critique and et cetera, I've made works that acknowledge my positionality. So there's a short piece called Learning to Walk Like Radha, which is part of a larger show called Suno, Tell Me Sister. Suno means listen in Hindi. And in the piece, I kind of tell this, I narrate and dance this story with this giant, like, I don't know, 100 foot, 40 foot, I don't know, really long piece of cloth that is first like a braid on my head and it changes its identity throughout the course of the thing. But I narrate my first encounter with Cuttack and with my teacher and the sort of conflicts that I felt internally as somebody who is a feminist, was a U.S. feminist at the time, encountering kind of gender, performances of gender that felt uncomfortable to me, loving and worshiping my teacher and wanting to please her, wanting to, and you know, having enough like good Asian girl in me to not question my teachers vocally. And also like a kind of carefulness around my, you know, this might look patriarchal to me, but maybe it's deeper than that. Maybe I'm missing some deeper spiritual philosophy and I don't want to come in as this like first world Western feminist and be like, you know, you ignorant brown person, like this is how you should really be a feminist. And I actually say something along those lines in this section, which is improvised. And so there's a lot of kind of calling myself out. Right. And I even like, there's actually similarities between the Coldplay narrative and the way that I first got to India. I went to study freaking religious dance. You know, but I also, you know, I spent many months there. I've been back to India like 7-8 times since then, you know, like, and I didn't make a video about it right away and put it on the internet and make a lot of money about it. But I've had from the beginning a kind of like questioning of myself in terms of my first worldness, in terms of my a wish to sort of engage with India in terms of spirituality, and in which I have continued to question through my work and through the making of my work for many years, and that relationship has continued to evolve across time. So I'll talk very briefly about two different pieces that I made in dialogue with Postnatyam in different ways. So the first I mentioned already, it's called Suno, Tell Me Sister. It kind of premiered in 2011. And it was a piece about women's voices being silenced and finding voice. And then a more recent piece I did over the past couple of years is called Super Ruashi Origins. And this piece is a live comic book story featuring a superheroine who by day is a nerdy Chinese American teenager and by night is a feminist superheroine. So she discovers that she's the hairy armpitted feminist and she has magical gender bending body odor that, you know, can change the course of patriarchal oppression and overturn all gender injustice. So the story, so what this piece does is it actually resets lots of elements of Indian performance, because I say dance, but actually music, dance, and theater are very intertwined. So there's a lot of acting components and use of costume and sets and whatever that are part of performance, part of Natya, that
that are part of Indian classical dance. So anyway, it takes many elements of Indian classical performance and puts it into a context where it's no longer about performing Indianness solely and primarily. So that piece, you know, does do a kind of critique of conservative Hindu mythology. So a lot of my work is very feminist. A lot of my work is very much thinking about queering. A lot of my work is thinking about complicating identity politics without throwing away identity politics. But it also makes it viable to tell a Chinese American story. And I'll just be really clear that I don't identify as Chinese American because I'm super Taiwanese, but it worked better for purposes of the story. And to tell a story that's not about Indianness, but using elements of Indian performance. So those are two different examples.
And we have to wrap up, but really quickly, I wanted to ask both of you what you're working on right now.
So I am currently working on developing a new piece called Vessels. It's a 7-woman harmonic meditation on the middle passage that I want to do on a ship, on a vessel, in a body of water in New Orleans. So either on the lake, like Pontchartrain, or in the Mississippi River. Mm. It's amazing and large and wonderful. And then I'm working on touring my solo performance, Looking Out Abroad, that explores the constructions and expectations of Black women's identity around the world.
And Sin, what about you?
I am working on a project called Blood Run. This is a piece that is looking at my Han colonizer and Taiwanese Plains indigenous heritages, and I didn't find out about my possible indigenous heritage until several years ago when I was in my 30s already. So it's looking at assimilation, racial mixing, that kind of thing. So that piece is being created in dialogue with Postnatium as part of a process we're engaging in called Reimagining Citizenship, where we're thinking about citizenship and its exclusions and how a nation state decides who gets to be fully human and not. Mm-hmm. And so we're each looking at our own kind of areas of interest and relationship to us. So yeah, that piece will premiere April 8th through 10th at the Boom Festival in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then Nina and I will do a shared show, which we've titled More Than Less Than, which is inspired by Fred Moten's ideas and words, at the Highways Performance Space in Santa Monica, California, June 16th and 17th in mid-June. Look on Highways' website to figure it out.
Well, fantastic. I feel like we can all be here all day. Thank you both for coming on and for giving us your thoughts.
You're welcome.
We're back with some recommendations and close out the show. Deep, she just came up with it. What's your recommendation for this week?
Okay, I'm not recommending a show so much as a concept that people should really do more. This weekend, I saw 1776 at New York City Center, starring Santino Fontana and John Larroquette.
Larroquette.
Something like that. I cannot pronounce things, as we all know by now. And
you got Fontana right.
Huh?
You got Fontana right.
Because it's like cheese.
Okay.
Anyway, and side note, I've never seen that musical, so it was really a fun experience. It was more entertaining than I thought it was going to be, actually. And fantastic book. I think it's like one of the best books for a musical I've ever heard, because it's better than the actual music.
Peter Stone.
Yep, Peter Stone. Anyhow, they did this with a multiracial cast, you know, stemming from Hamilton. And some of the casting choices were really interesting. Like, the one that stood out to me was, and I'm totally blanking on her name, but Thomas Jefferson's wife, she was played by a Black actress, which was really interesting because in real life, Martha Jefferson was the half-sister of Sally Hemings, who Thomas Jefferson had a lot of kids with.
Right.
So there's that. I don't know if they intended it to have that additional dimension, but it really brought there's like some undertones there that
Who did Andre DeShields play? I saw his name on the cast list.
Yeah, Andre DeShields played the Rhode Island representative who was kind of a drunkard for the most of it, which was kind of problematic to me. Since you don't want the one black man with the really meaty role to be the drunkard.
Be the drunk.
Yeah. But it did make it a lot more interesting and colorful. So I recommend anyone who's doing 1776 to consider that when you cast. Take a note from Hamilton. Have a black man play John Adams or a Latino man or anyone else.
You could do that.
Yeah.
I'm going to just jump on that. And my recommendation is that I haven't done the work of actually reading this essay, but there's an interview with the author of the essay in Slate with Rebecca Onion, who's a great history reporter for Slate, with Lyra Montero, who has, I think, from what I've read of this great interview she does, sort of the best pushback about Hamilton because, there was a piece on HowlRound which I thought was a little overblown in its backlash. But she just makes the point that, look, it is a very conventional telling of the – it's not a point that many people have – it's not a radical point to point. It's a very conventional telling of the founding. It erases the people of color who were around. There are no people of color in the character list. It's all – they're played by people of color, but it's still a white story. And, you know, I've been reading more and more about how Hamilton, yes, he was a member of the Manumission Society, seemed to be in favor of abolition. But the extent to which he was really emotionally or viscerally against slavery, he probably was too poor to have slaves, which is the only reason he didn't have, and that he might have hired a few. I mean, slavery was a system that it was a big deal to be against. So it's not like everybody was, it wasn't always the main topic of conversation. So she sort of accuses the musical of doing a thing called Founding Fathers Chic, where the Founding Fathers are seen to be cool, relatable guys with things we can identify with. She also says she loved it. So she's someone who loved it as a musical, but has interesting critiques to make. She said, you know, also, this is something I attribute to the sort of, I see a parallel with the hip hop narrative. The hip hop narrative of sort of pulling yourself up for your bootstraps and making your name is a very macho kind of conservative idea. And that's kind of, Lin-Manuel definitely saw that. That's what he recognized in the biography of Hamilton, this sort of like upstart who gets a lot farther by working harder and so on. And she just sort of calls that out as being a conservative notion.
Well, it's a very Americana kind of dream.
Right.
It's the American dream.
I think basically what it amounts to, like, I think it's a useful critique. It basically just puts into words again, it's a very mainstream. It's a mainstream musical. The fact that it's a mainstream musical full of people of color, I think, is a big deal. But it is a mainstream. What's one of the reasons it's great? It's like brings new voices into a great mainstream form, which is an American form, which is one reason why it's become such a mainstream hit.
Yeah. Well, actually, that reminds me of Katori Hall's essay, which she wrote when Kent State University did the White Mountaintop. And in it, there was one part where she wrote about Hamilton and how even though people of color are playing it, it's bolstering the achievements of white men by using black and Latino bodies to do it.
Right. I mean, I think the counter for me is that, like, it also, in the way that when people of color do Shakespeare, the compromise, it's claiming it too. It's not just honoring and bolstering white authors and white founding fathers. It's claiming their narrative as our narrative today. So I think I see both sides of it.
Right.
And so I recommend highly, it's a Q&A on Slate with Rebecca Onion and Lyra Montero. I'm going to now read Lyra Montero's piece, which I'm not sure was published that she's referring to. So Susie, sorry, that was a long-winded.
I'm going to recommend, I went to one of my favorite events of the year last night, and there's always some good videos that come out of it. I went to MCC's gala, which galas are usually not super fun, but MCC does it as miscast and gets a bunch of stars to sing parts that they are not right for. And it's always a lot of fun. And so usually they videotape all the performances and they show up on Theater Mania or Playbill or some of those sites. And, I know for a fact some of them will show up, but some of the highlights of the evening. So if you feel like YouTube's spiraling, Gavin Creel and Aaron Tveit sang, Take Me or Leave Me from Rent in, really tight pants. And it was pretty, Wonderful. K.L. Settle sang The Impossible Dream. And I think the highlight of the night, I don't know if there'll be video of this, but hopefully there is. Titus Burgess sang, he sang a song from Into the Woods, which was wonderful. He played the witch, which he did, I think, in Florida.
Yes, he did.
This is not miscasting.
No, it wasn't. But then he got up to sing a duet, and he makes this big stink, and he's like, no one wanted to sing this duet with me, and everybody left. And then Tina Fey was at the event, and she whipped a microphone out of her purse and goes, I'll sing it with you, and sang You're Nothing Without Me with Titus Burgess on stage. And it was pretty much a highlight. It was a really fun event. So hopefully there'll be some videos up later this week and you can see some great performances.
No one sang Pinot Noir?
No, but I feel like Tina made a joke in the middle of them singing, and she was like, You're Nothing Without Me, and she's like, Pinot by Titus, really?
Actually, Titus Burgess does have a Pinot Noir now.
He has a line of Pinot Noirs.
Oh, my God.
That's why she was like, Pinot by Titus, You're Nothing Without Me.
Apparently, it's $24, so.
I'm interested.
The best wine $24 can buy.
Anyway, it was a very delightful evening. Yeah, so check out the videos.
Great. Well, another blockbuster issue or edition of Off Script. Go on to iTunes, rate us. Like us, write reviews. People can find us better that way. All right. Till next time.